But now on Radio 3, it's time for Composer of the Week at Donald MacLeod. This week's composer is Henry Cowell, and today Donald explores a very difficult period in his life when he finds himself in serious trouble with the authorities.
The kind of wild things Henry Cowell was doing in his experimental pieces, generating exciting new sounds and fascinating rhythms, soon attracted the attention of contemporary dancers. Yvonne Daunt presented an evening of dance to his music in 1933, and Cowell met the modern dance pioneers Doris Humphrey and Charles Wideman, whose adventurous company Denishawn was based in Los Angeles. In 1931, Cowell wrote this piece for Wideman, which shows an entirely different side of his nature from the ultra-modernist fist-and-elbows composer of dissonant piano works of the preceding decade. Dance of Sport also shows that Cowell and Wideman clearly had a sense of humour.
Thank you.
Dance of Sport, originally called Competitive Sport, a movement from one of several dance pieces Henry Cowell composed in the 1930s. The California Parallel Ensemble was directed by Nicole Paimon. The 1930s were a challenging time for professional musicians in the USA, as everyone else across the world, following the Wall Street crash of October 1929. In 1933, the New York Musicians Union reckoned 80% of its members were unemployed. Cowell was spending the majority of his time giving lectures rather than concerts. Despite having no formal qualifications, he was offered a job developing a music program at New York's New School for Social Research. It suited Cowell since it had been set up as a reaction against traditional academe. One of a series of lectures there was on world music, something he'd been aware of as a child growing up in a very unconventional environment. In the mid-1920s, Cowell presented a series of innovative concerts of non-Western music played by non-Western performers who happened to live in New York. In 1931, after submitting an application backed up by a totally formidable array of referees, including Bartok and Carlos Chavez, Cowell was awarded a Guggenheim Foundation grant to study comparative musicology with Erich von Hornbostel in Berlin. He'd already been studying the raga and tala systems of North India with an Indian musician, as well as Arabic music, African drumming, and the gamelan, and at some point he also took up the shakuhachi, the Japanese flute. In 1935, Cowell published a book called The Scientific Approach to Non-European Music, in which he set out a pioneering breadth of approach that would bring together psychology, physiology, religion, social conditions, climatic factors, and the relation of animal and vegetable life to the instruments, by which we would not only better understand the musics of other peoples, but also gain a proper perspective in which to understand our own music and its role in relation to the other musics of the world. This is Cowell's piece for shakuhachi called Universal Flute.
Thank you.
The shakuhachi player Ralph Samuelson performed Universal Flute by Henry Cowell. Some years later, Cowell made a trip to Japan, where, as you can imagine, he was thrilled to hear the sound of the sho, a beautiful bird-like-looking mouth organ which produces tone clusters. During the 1930s, Cowell wrote some 70 pieces, although 20% of those have since been lost. His previously favoured medium, solo piano, dropped, and now his interest turned to chamber music, larger forms, and, as I mentioned earlier, music allied to dance. The classes on rhythm that he taught brought him into regular contact with dancers. Well, my guest all this week, Professor of Music History, Chamber Music and New Music Performance at the Juilliard School, where he conducts the new Juilliard Ensemble, is Joel Sachs. Joel, how important was this connection between music and dance for Cowell?
Oh, I think it was extremely important. He himself enjoyed dancing, apparently, but this was on a very different level because he was so fascinated by the idea of collaborative projects between the art forms. In fact, he was very troubled by the relationship between music and choreography because he felt that what he saw around him all the time was choreography being composed to existing music or music being composed to existing choreography, and he wondered how it might be possible for the two to grow together. And it was in that context that he began thinking about what he called elastic form, in which he would provide, and one very good example is to Martha Graham, the materials for a piece in the form of snippets of melody and perhaps harmony, but done in such a way that the choreographer could reassemble them, multiply them, divide them, and put them in any order as the dance piece began to take shape in his or her mind. And it must have been quite remarkable to see how this process worked, but it was certainly the beginning of the concept open form, which became very important to composers after the Second World War, in which a performer would be given different bits of music and be in a position to put them together however he or she wished to do it.
Well, let's hear that demonstrated in Sound Form Number 1, a short quintet for woodwinds and percussion. In this recording, we hear the original, and then it's repeated with added percussion interludes and changed articulation. I don't know what sort of choreography was envisioned for this piece, but as you'll hear, the flute line has a distinctly oriental feel.
Thank you.
In Henry Cowell's Sound Form No. 1, the flautist was Lita Miller, with the clarinetist Mark Brandenburg, bassoonist Jane Orzel, and percussionist Russell Greenberg and Michael Strunk. Cowell composed that piece in 1937 in, to say the least, unusual circumstances. He was serving a sentence in San Quentin prison. Joel, of the many strange and complex stories in Henry Cowell's life, this is the most extraordinary. He spent 4 years in prison. That's rather surprising because there was never any trial. How did he come to be there? It all started with a swimming pool, I think.
He was accused of having had oral sex with an adult, a young man, but he was adult. Later, it turned out that the young man was trying to frame him so that he could get his car. The weird thing about California law at that time was that you could be sent to prison for up to 15 years for a single act of oral sex, even if it was with your wife. Of course, no one watches bedrooms, fortunately. It was preposterous, and the reason he ended up with it, according to the district attorney, the prosecutor, is that he pleaded guilty, partly because his parents had taught him that lawyers just take your money and do nothing. So he pleaded guilty without benefit of counsel, and the district attorney later said if he hadn't, he never would have been prosecuted. He said he thought this was a really stupid law, and it never should have been on the books. But in those days, there were indeterminate sentences, so he got 1 to 15 years in prison, but the prison board of sentencing was hardline, and they felt 15 years it is.
One of the striking things that comes out from your account of all this is the number of people who continued to believe in him and supported him. Some of them were people that he'd known for some time, but this is where we encounter a rather remarkable figure who's going to play a very significant role in his future life.
And that's Sidney Robertson. Yeah, Sidney had known Henry vaguely since she was a student, and he gave some classes, I think, or some piano lessons at her school when she was very little. And they became very close friends. She took his courses at the new school and was very, very impressed by everything. And when he was in prison, she came faithfully, as long as she was in California, every 4 weeks, which was the span of time that had to elapse before you could come back.
You got to know Sidney rather well in doing the immense research on this book. I mean, what motivated her in the first place to get involved with his case?
Well, Sidney was an absolutely remarkable woman. She was incredibly brilliant. She was a first-class photographer. She was also a very fine pianist and an excellent writer. And I think what she saw in Henry Cowell was a man of incredible brilliance. Sidney felt he'd gotten a really bad deal, that he never should have been in prison to begin with. And certainly if he had to go to prison, it should have been for the smallest amount of time. So she really believed in him.
Cowell was obviously a man of rather complex sexuality, but he had had a number of relationships with women.
Two of them he nearly married. One of them was his landlady in Berlin. And earlier than that, he had been apparently engaged to a woman called Edna Smith, who was a Columbia University student, a very brilliant woman, a very generous woman who was very wealthy. And unfortunately, in 1922, her car was hit by a train and she and her sister were killed.
We're going to hear now a piece which Cowell is thought to have written in response to Edna Smith's death. It's a setting of words by Edna St. Vincent Millay. Where She Lies is sung by Mary Ann Hart.
Keep not on this mind.
Marianne Hart was the singer and Jeanne Golan the pianist in Henry Cowell's song Where She Lies. You're listening to Composer of the Week with me, Donald McLeod, on BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, online and digital. This week, exploring the extraordinary life and times of 20th century American composer Henry Cowell, with my guest, Cowell's biographer, Joel Sachs. Joel, so here is Cowell locked up in San Quentin in cell 1841, about 4 feet by eight. What were the conditions like? What did he do all day?
Well, he had to work all day. All the prisoners worked. And for the first year, he was put into the jute mill, making jute bags for the state of California, which was obviously very, very dangerous for his hands, especially. But he got to know the education department, and eventually he was transferred there, where he began teaching. He apparently taught music to something like 2,500 inmates, which is pretty astounding and may account for the fact that San Quentin Prison was the state prison with the highest proportion of participation in educational courses in that period. He got involved with the band. In fact, Sidney Cowell said that there was a musician in prison who was the ranking murderer and protected him from abuse by the other prisoners. And she thought it was a guy named Raul Pereira, who had been a violin student of Joseph Joachim. But Pereira was in for bad checks, so he was only in for a year. It turned out that the real protector was Hendrix, the bandmaster, who was a vicious murderer, but he liked Cowell, and he got out the word, leave him alone. I think also it's possible nobody bothered him because he played a lot of concerts for the other prisoners, which they seem to have liked.
We're going to hear now a piece by Cowell called Deep Colour, composed in 1938, again, while he was still in San Quentin. Tell me about this piece.
He had a very close friend in Chicago called Georgia Kober, who was a very fine pianist and also the director of a conservatory, a woman very interested in new music. And she asked if he would write a couple of pieces for her, which he did. One is called High Colour, which refers to the colour of the mountains in Ireland, and Deep Colour, the colour of the valleys. He said these titles don't really mean much of anything, but they are very evocative, that's for sure.
The unmistakably Celtic atmosphere of Deep Colour by Henry Cowell, played there by my guest, Cowell's biographer, Joel Sachs. Joel, in 1940, after 4 years in San Quentin prison, Cowell finally got parole. How did that come about?
A long campaign with a very important lawyer. Sidney Cowell, for some reason, didn't think much of this lawyer, but I know from reading all of the correspondence, which she had in the archive and should have known, that he was working really hard. In fact, it's quite possible that he's the one who got the law changed. But it took many attempts because the board was very hardline until a new governor was elected in 1938. And he discovered that there were tremendous sentencing disparities between California prisons and the rest of the country. And he was determined that there would be a thorough overhaul of the prison system, which included getting rid of the Board of Prison Terms and Paroles and appointing a new board. And eventually, in that way, he was able to get a parole. He was paroled to the custody of Percy Granger and his wife in Yonkers, New York, just outside New York City, and to the tender mercies of a parole officer who seems to have been a very good man who made it possible for Cowell to function as best he could.
His being sent to prison for this presumed offence sharply divided his friends.
Yes, it did. It really did. It was thought that the Iveses, who were very close to him, I think Charles Ives regarded him as the son he never had, the Iveses split off from him. But I think the problem was that Mrs. Ives was an old New England woman who had very strong moral ideas, but especially was afraid that if she told Charles about it, he might have another heart attack and die. He was in very, very precarious health in the 1930s. But eventually, an intermediary kind of brought them together again. But of course, the decisive moment was the announcement of his engagement to Sidney Robertson, at which point Mrs. Ives sent him a wonderful present and welcomed him back.
Well, after 4 years of comparative isolation in San Quentin, Cowell found that the effects of Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal and the outbreak of World War II had changed the climate in America, and he embarked on composing a series of larger-scale works, including concertos and a series of symphonies. We're going to end today with a complete performance of his Symphony No. 11 from 1953, which he called Seven Rituals of Music. Cowell explained the title. There are seven rituals of music in the life of man from birth to death. The symphony begins with gentle music for a child asleep. Then comes a busy movement with percussion, music for the ritual of work. Third movement is a song for the ritual of love, followed by music for the ritual of dance and play. Fifth is the ritual of magic and the mystical imagination. Then comes the dance that prepares for war, and then a fugal finale that weaves together the six themes that have gone before, leading to the music of the ritual of death, which begins as a lament.
Thank you.
Robert S. Whitney conducted the Louisville Orchestra in Henry Cowell's Symphony No. 11, Seven Rituals of Music. Cowell may not have missed San Quentin, but they missed him. Schuder, the director of education at San Quentin, said life seemed dull without him. Life back in the world beyond the prison walls was not without its difficulties for Cowell. Find out what he did to overcome them and hear another of his large-scale works, his Variations for Orchestra, tomorrow.
And that was Donald MacLeod.